Welcome. Thank you very much for coming. I am the Executive Director of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center. My name is Renee Redman. And again, I'd like to thank you all for coming. And I'd like to thank Hughes, Hubbard, and Reed for donating this space and facilities and the food. Please help yourselves. I'm going to introduce our two panelists shortly. We're very excited to have Shadi Sadr and Payam Akhavan here. But before that, I'd like to tell you a little bit about the center and about the report that we're releasing today, which is in the center of your tables. IHRDC is a nonpartisan independent human rights organization that was founded in 2004. We are located in New Haven, and contrary to the press lately, we are not part of Yale University. We never have been part of Yale University, but we are in New Haven. We are have the distinction of being one of the 60 organizations that the Iranian Interior Ministry recently condemned as subversive. Our goal is to document human rights violations since the 1979 revolution in Iran. The purpose is so that these events will not be forgotten, and hopefully by shedding light on these events, we can dissuade the regime from continuing with these actions, and also to enable either Iranian courts and bodies, and as well as international bodies, to hold the perpetrators accountable. We seek to encourage a culture of human rights in Iran, regardless of who is in power. We have two basic programs. One is a very large database, which is available on our website. It contains historical documents as well as witness statements in English and in Persian. We've just started to delve into doing video witness statements, too, so you're welcome to look at those. They are subtitles in English. And we also have a program where we investigate and analyze various events that have happened throughout the last 30 years, and we publish them in reports, also in English and in Persian. They are available on our website. The most recent one is in front of you. This report covers the events from the election on June 12th, this last June 12th, and we had to necessarily end on December 31st just for publishing deadlines. As I said, the English version is in front of you. It's available on our website. There is a Persian version of the introduction in the hallway. We will have the Persian version of the entire report available sometime in March. So, although this report is the longest report we've ever produced, we have to view it as a preliminary report. Witnesses are still coming out of Iran, people are fleeing as they become more settled. They're more willing and able to discuss their experiences. And of course, as we all know just from reading any paper, the Iranian regime has continued to suppress any expression of dissent. In other words, this event, so to speak, is certainly not over. During the last month or so, we watched as the regime cracked down on dissent in preparation for the 31st anniversary of the revolution, which took place yesterday. Many people commented, they said, well, we didn't see many demonstrators on the streets in Iran yesterday, and there didn't seem to be a lot going on. Well, we have to remember that over the last month or so, since after Ashura, which was December 27th, the Iranian regime was arresting hundreds, if not thousands, of people. It executed two men purportedly in relation to the demonstrations. However, these two men had been arrested before the demonstrations, in fact, quite a bit before the demonstrations in June. And they were arrested purportedly because they were connected or part of an obscure royalist society, and their convictions were based on their confessions, which were undoubtedly forced. This is a calculated move by the government. It desensitizes the population because hopefully, in their eyes, the Iranian population as well as the international community will not pay much attention to these people who are not reformist or opposition figures. And, of course, the next step in this would be to actually sentence higher priority people to execution. And in fact, one person who was arrested during Ashura has been sentenced to execution for his demonstration activities. The government also suddenly decided to try the seven Baha'is who had been in jail since 2008. But for those of you who don't know, Baha'i is an outlawed religion in Iran. It's not supposed to exist. These seven people were arrested in 2008, have been languishing in prison. And in February, their trial started. They've had two sessions, the last of which was this last Sunday. They are accused of national security charges, and of course, spying for Israel. The government also shut down a lot of electronic communications. We, of course, don't know specifically, but the internet was slowed. Those of us who watched news coming out of Iran noticed that there was the levels were much less yesterday. It was slowed. People did not have access to Google, apparently, or their Gmail. Suddenly today, we're starting to hear from people. So there was definitely a communications blackout, which points to another aspect of this crisis, is that journalists are being arrested and fleeing in the hundreds from Iran. And so therefore, we're getting even less information than we were getting before, less reliable information. So I'm not going to repeat what's in our 100-page report. You can read that for yourselves. But I will say that it does present a picture of a regime who feels threatened and therefore has resorted to many actions that it has used in the past. For example, it has been violently suppressing the demonstrations with beatings, arrests, and killings. It's violated people's freedoms of expression and assembly. And, of course, it has murdered people. It has arrested and detained not only demonstrators, but people who were not active in the demonstrations, including minority activists, women's rights activists, opposition figures, academics, students, basically anybody the regime believes might be a leader in dissenting against government policies. While in prison, people are regularly tortured, subjected to long terms of solitary confinement, long excruciating interrogation sessions, rape, sexual violence, and people die. The regime this last summer also held mass show trials, which looked very much like Stalin, rooms of 100. The first trial had 100 defendants. A document called an indictment was read. It wasn't anything that remotely resembled an indictment either in Iranian or in international or U.S. law. It was basically a political statement. And after that, some defendants were chosen to confess, which many, if history holds true, many, if not all, of these confessions were forced and due to the fact that these people had been threatened and or tortured. So none of these methods of suppression are unusual. The regime has been arresting people without warrants, using excessive force, interrogating people, torturing them, and executing them since 1979. I'd like to stress that this is illegal under Iranian as well as international law. The Iranian Constitution prohibits the use of torture, prohibits the use of forced confessions, provides for due process rights for people who are arrested, including the right to a lawyer and the right to know the charges against them. So IHRDC, the center, has joined the calls of many organizations to urge to have the Iranian regime stop arresting political dissenters, and to allow people to express their dissent to government policies, to stop beating, arresting, and killing demonstrators. Also for the immediate release of all political prisoners, especially those who are arrested merely for their expressions and their associations, to stop executing political prisoners, particularly when the executions are based on forced confessions, and to institute a system of investigation, of real investigation, whereby the perpetrators and the people who are responsible for these actions can be brought to justice and be held accountable. It is entirely possible that these actions also constitute crimes against humanity. The center does not is still looking at this evidence and has not reached any firm conclusions on this. However, if these actions turned out to be widespread, systematic, and pursuant to a policy against the civilian populations, they will constitute crimes against humanity. So that said, I'd like to introduce our panelists. Our first panelist is Shadi Sadr, who is a very well-known human rights attorney from Iran. She has successfully defended women who were sentenced to execution in Iran. She's also the founder and chief editor of the Zanan e Iran website. The site is the first network designed to distribute information and promote knowledge sharing among feminist activists in Iran. She was also one of a number of feminist activists who began a Laws Without Stoning campaign in 2006. She has won several awards, the most recent of which in 2009 was the Human Rights Prize for L'Equivalenza organization, which she shared with Laden and Roya Boramond. She also was awarded in 2009 the Dutch Human Rights Defenders Tulip Award. Ms. Sadr, Attorney Sadr, has been arrested twice for her human rights work in Iran. First, in 2005, she was arrested in front of the Revolutionary Court in Tehran, where she and 32 other activists from the feminist movement had assembled in front of the court. She was detained for 2 weeks. The most recent time that she was arrested was in July 17, 2009. She was arrested by plainclothes agents while on her way to Friday prayers. She was released 11 days after being detained in Evin prison, which is a notorious prison in Tehran. Our second panelist, Payam Akhavan, is a professor of international law at McGill University in Montreal, Canada. He earned his doctorate from Harvard Law and was previously a senior fellow at Yale Law School. He's the author of numerous publications on international law. He was the first United Nations war crimes prosecutor at The Hague, played a key role in the trial of Yugoslav leaders, including President Milosevic. He's also served with the UN in Bosnia, Cambodia, Guatemala, East Timor, and Rwanda, and has been appointed as legal counsel in leading cases before the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court, the European Court of Human Rights. I should also say that he is a co-founder of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center and is on our board. He will discuss the actions of the Iranian regime under international law, and Ms. Sadr will discuss these violations under Iranian law as well as the weaknesses of the judiciary in Iran. I'd like to start with Ms. Sadr.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay.
Can you see me, Shadi?
Yes, okay. Yes. Okay, hello everybody, and thank you to be here. 8 months after the people's protest to the declared outcomes of the presidential election, human rights conditions in Iran have deteriorated noticeably. Peaceful gatherings have been brutally suppressed. People have been beaten with batons, tear gassed, injured or killed and arrested. In prison, they have been put into solitary confinement for long periods and suffered physical and mental torture, rape, and slaughter. In July 2009, Mehdi Karoubi, one of two reformist candidates, formed a fact-finding committee to investigate cases involving in violation of protesters' rights, particularly rape and murder. The central members of this committee were arrested when the first report was sent to the parliament and the judiciary, and witnesses to the violence were seriously threatened or silenced. 4 months later, Nowruz, the news website belonging to Musharakat, the most important reformist party in Iran, published a detailed report on the clandestine burial of more than 100 men and women had been killed in street protests or in prisons, along with photos of the graves. Meanwhile, the Iranian military court maintained that only three protesters had been killed in Kahrizak, one of the most notorious detention centers in Tehran, due to severe torture. At the same time, the parliament launched an ad hoc fact-finding committee to investigate the complaints of torture and killing of detainees who were arrested in post-election protests. According to the committee, three detainees were tortured to death in Kahrizak Detention Center. In a report published on January 10, 2010, the committee recognized Saeed Mortazavi, Tehran's former prosecutor general, as the main person responsible for the death of the three young men. Unfortunately, however, he has neither been summoned to the court nor been officially accused or questioned. Similar events occurred in 2004 when Mortazavi's name came up as one of those who raped and murdered Zahra Kazemi, an Iranian-Canadian photojournalist who was killed in Evin prison. This treatment of prosecutors and political dissidents violates Iranian law. However, once again, public opinion protesters and human rights activists have recognized the lack of independence of the judiciary and the lack of justice in the political system in Iran. Thus, I would like to find out why the judicial system cannot offer justice in the cases of violation of human rights, especially in the cases of the rape and sexual abuse in the prisons. Article 164 of the Iranian Constitution notes that a judge cannot be removed from the post he occupies, whether temporary or permanently, except by trial and proof of his guilt, or in consequence of a violation entailing his dismissal. A judge cannot be transferred or redesignated without his consent, except in cases when the interest of society necessitates it, that too with the decision of the head of judiciary branch after consultation with the chief of the Supreme Court and the prosecutor general. Therefore, the head of judiciary can simply transfer a judge with the excuse that it is in the interest of society, which is a very flexible concept and can be interpreted many ways. In addition, judges refuse to address cases of torture in prison, especially rape cases, because of the dominance and influence of security and arbitrary agencies. For instance, on October 2007, Zahra Bani Yaqub, a young doctor in the city of Hamedan, was arrested in a park by besieged militia along with her boyfriend. She was accused of breaking moral rules which do not allow any extramarital relationships. 48 hours later, her body was delivered to her family. The authorities from the besieged detention center announced she had committed suicide in detention, but her family and lawyer Shirin Ebadi called her death suspicious. They filed an official complaint. According to the forensic report, she had two bruises on the left and right thighs, and Bani Yaqub's family and lawyer announced she had also been the subject of rape in prison. 2 months later, the media received an official order that banned them from publishing anything about Zahra's case. Immediately after, the Hamedan judiciary closed the cases. No one had been accused of Zahra's death. The final verdict of the appeals court was also the same. 1 year later, Dr. Zahra Bani Yaqub's family wrote an open letter to the Iranian people describing the details of her case. They state that the judge threatened them into withdrawing their complaint and seek a peaceful way to solve the problem in a meeting which Colonel A.H., his full name was never really revealed, attended. During an interview in 2009, the family attorney said that some documents which proved that the detention center's authorities, especially Colonel A.H., were responsible for Zahra's treatment had been lost. Bani Yaqub's case shows how the lack of democratic mechanisms, including judicial independence, freedom of press, and independent civil society organizations to monitor and control the state machinery, make judicial accountability impossible. Extrajudicial bodies are not independent. For example, according to the Article 90 of the Constitution, whoever was a complaint concerning the work of the Parliament or the executive power or the judicial power can forward his complaint in writing to the Parliament. The Parliament must investigate his complaint and give a satisfactory reply. In cases where the complaint relates to the executive or the judiciary, the Parliament must demand proper investigation in the matter and an adequate explanation from them and announce the results within a reasonable time. In cases where the subject of the complaint is of public interest, the reply must be made public. The commission created pursuant to this article is called Article 90 Commission. The cases of Zahra Kazemi is one example showing that this extrajudicial institution is not able to bring justice. Zahra Kazemi was a Canadian-Iranian photojournalist. She was arrested in 2003 in front of Evin prison while taking photos of a gathering of some families of the student movement activists who were being held in the prison. According to Iranian authorities, she died due to head trauma caused by a fall during a hunger strike. Her family filed a complaint against Evin's authorities and the case was investigated by the Article 90 Commission. After years, the Islamic Republic's judicial system charged only one low-ranking employee of the Ministry of Intelligence. However, Dr. Azam, who worked at Tehran's Baghiyatullah Military Hospital, testified before the Article 90 Commission that he had observed many signs of beating, rape, and torture on Kazemi's body. His testimony about the rape was not mentioned in the final report, and nobody accused for the rape officially. Therefore, the question of the impunity of perpetrators of human rights violations in Iran's judicial system remains. That's why many human rights activists are resorting to international or transnational justice in cases of grave human rights violations, including rape and sexual torture of political prisoners. Since the statute of the International Criminal Court has not been ratified by Iran, only the UN Security Council can consider referring cases of crime against humanity to an international criminal court. But civil society, especially human rights activists, especially after the 2009 events and after the election, have many ideas and initiatives about fact-finding commissions, courts, and the use of dramatic mechanism in European and American courts for trial and punishment of those who ordered and perpetrated human rights violation in Iran. Before the summer of 2009, various groups, and especially those in the political opposition, raised the demand for criminal prosecution and punishment of those who ordered and perpetrated widespread and systematic human rights violations in Iran. In the first decade following the Islamic Revolution, many members and supporters of opposition groups were imprisoned, tortured, and executed. Those who survived joined writers, intellectuals, and political activists who had survived a similar purge committed by Ministry of Intelligence officers, and together they raised their demands for justice in forms of articles, speeches, political statements, or practical steps. Nevertheless, with the popular protest following the June 2009 election, the necessity of adopting effective mechanisms for criminal prosecution seemed more important than ever. When outlining the evolution of human rights discourse in Iran, we see that in the early years following the revolution, human rights activism was limited to those political activists who denounced human rights violation in Iran from exile. After the Iran-Iraq war, when the social space was relatively open, many human rights NGOs were launched, which continued later on when the reformists came to power. Most of their activities were confined to the field of human rights training of civil society activists and did not probe deep into the political structure. More independent groups, which were mostly made up of lawyers, work in a similar framework of denouncing human rights violations and raising awareness. They tried to improve the human rights situation by releasing new concerning crucial cases. At the same time, some activists gradually introduced the need for systematic documentation of human rights violations, especially after the wide release of memoirs by political prisoners from the 1980s, as well as by intellectuals and activists who were suppressed in the 1990s for fighting for ethnic and religious minority rights, women's rights, and workers' rights. Some Iranian human rights organizations then began documenting cases of systematic human rights violations by the Islamic Republic. They published their documentation, which was mostly based on the testimony of victims and their families, along with reports of the massacre of political prisoners in 1988, repression of Baha'is, the political purges of intellectuals, and so on. However, it is remarkable how little documentation has been done considering the breadth of systematic human rights violation that exists, including the violation of women's rights, particularly rape and sexual torture of women political prisoners, and the violation of the rights of ethnic minorities, particularly Kurds. Although the need still exists to document and prepare legal evidence against those who ordered and perpetrated widespread and systematic violation of human rights, it seems that human rights discourse in Iran is now tending to pursue and punish violators of human rights. In fact, Iranian human rights discourse is now in the transition phase from denouncing violations and raising awareness to a more proactive strategy of documentation and holding violators accountable. Meanwhile, another feature that distinguishes the human rights discourse of the current era, especially after the election, is the strategy of activists to frame the systematic and widespread human rights violation as crimes against humanity, and thus use international legal mechanisms to hold the perpetrators accountable. In fact, many human rights defenders are now trying to verify every instance of crimes against humanity in the 30 years of the Islamic Republic based on existing evidence in order to bring these cases to the international community. They hope that by doing this, they will compel the international community to honor its responsibility to follow through on cases of human rights violations within the country. It seems that the international political landscape has become more sensitive to the human rights issue in Iran, and under backdrop of the Iranian nuclear question, has become more receptive to such activities. This has created a unique opportunity for these activists to become visible and be heard. It is for this reason that civil society activists now discuss mechanism ideas such as holding a civil symbolic tribunal based on the Russell Tribunal experience, launching a fact-finding commission, submitting complaints in countries that accept the universal jurisdiction principle, as well as to some United Nations commissions and bodies. In conclusion, human rights activists are in agreement that an urgent need exists for a process of social dialogue and intervention, one in which civil society is able to hold human rights violators accountable and ensure that such crimes against humanity are not repeated. This is a real and a strong demand, but the question which is still remaining is how the idea of justice for Iran should be made real. In my opinion, this is the question for the future of Iran. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Shadi. I think that we will now hear from Payam Akhavan, and then I'll open up the floor for questions.
Thank you very much for being here today. I want to begin by thanking all those that have made this report possible. Of course, the hardworking staff of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center under the leadership of our executive director, Renee Redman. And I also want to recognize gratefully the support of the Canadian government. As a Canadian Iranian, I'm particularly proud that the Canadian government has taken a leadership role in consistently raising the matter of Iran's human rights record before the UN General Assembly. And of course, when one thinks that the first report of the Documentation Center was on the brutal torture and murder of Zahra Kazemi, who also was a Canadian-Iranian, one sees the entanglement right from the beginning of Canadian-Iranians. I want to also further to what my colleague Shadi Sadr has said, to explain now this question of the future, as she said, of justice. How are we now going to move from the phase of merely condemning human rights violations to creating a culture in which there will be accountability for such violations? And at the end of the day, if is a culture of impunity, if we restrict ourselves merely to condemnations which are easily forgotten, then we're never really going to be able to create a culture in which the rule of law prevails. In that respect, I would like to suggest further to what my esteemed, respected friend and colleague Shadi Sadr has said, that, as she said, the increasing demands for accountability are themselves part of the future Iran that is presently being built. The future Iran is already in the process of being built. And one of the unique features of what we see in Iran, which I think represents an unprecedented political maturity, is the connection between means and ends. The nonviolent nature of the protest movement in Iran, which I would submit is really not about who won the elections, but much broader grassroots social movement that embraces in its fold an exceptionally broad cross-section of Iranian society, from feminists to student leaders to human rights activists to labor unions, even those who are devout Shia Muslims, those who are secularists. And that is really the strength of the movement. So the nature of this movement, its articulation of its demands for accountability, rule of law, transparency, bringing to the surface the truth which has been repressed about human rights violations, all of those are already the nucleus of the future Iran, which is in the process of being made. So in that context, we have to see our current efforts at documentation, whether it is the efforts of those very brave people who, under very difficult circumstances, are trying to raise these issues in Iran, or our efforts abroad in the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center, which is necessary only because current circumstances don't allow for this sort of exercise to take place. You'll recall that after the protest violence in June, some of the reformist groups began some sort of process of documenting the violations that had taken place and were ultimately prosecuted. Their offices were raided. The documents which they had in their possession were used by the intelligence services to actually find collaborators who were then further arrested. So there's a reason why this exercise is taking place outside of Iran, at least in the activities of our center. It's simply because circumstances are not favorable to such an exercise in Iran. And it would be my hope, in a sense, that our activities would eventually be repatriated, if you like, to Iran at some point in the future. And if we look at the model, for example, of South Africa, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, we see that it did not await the end of apartheid before it began its activities. The various anti-apartheid activists, in collaboration with international civil society, were in the process of documenting these abuses long before the end of apartheid. And what was initially a non-governmental organization, an initiative of civil society, at the right point became transformed into an official Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which began to document these abuses and which became a central part of the post-apartheid transformation and the process of national reconciliation. So we need to think about these initial efforts at documentation in the broader light of we are, in a sense, setting the foundation together with those that are struggling in Iran. We, civil society outside of Iran, are contributing to that process and setting a discourse and a foundation so that when circumstances change in Iran, we will already have made significant progress in the direction of promoting a culture of accountability. One of the problems when we think about the respective role of the international community and what's happening in Iran is the fact that human rights are ultimately not taken too seriously. And I'll explain what I mean. Of course, there are resolutions at the United Nations General Assembly which criticize and condemn Iran's human rights record. Both René Redmond and I will be going to Geneva this weekend in anticipation next week of the consideration of Iran's human rights record by the UN Human Rights Council. These exercises are all important, and no regime wishes to be condemned or stigmatized or isolated for human rights abuses. But at the end of the day, we have to demonstrate, as we hear in all of these television shows about cops and robbers, they tell us crime does not pay. So the message has to be, at the end of the day, that there is a cost attached to committing atrocities. And in this case, we have to say crimes against humanity does not pay. Human rights abuses are not merely a reflection of sadism or some sort of a primordial aggression. They are the deliberate use of violence and terror as an instrument of power. I've served with the United Nations in places as diverse as the former Yugoslavia, Rwanda, Cambodia, and although each of those situations has its own unique circumstances, the story is always the same. There is nothing inherent about these conflicts which are ideological in their nature, whether they use religion or ethnicity or some other justification for repression. At the end of the day, what we're dealing with is the use of violence, torture, rape, murders, misinformation as an instrument of power. And the struggle of the international community and civil society has to be to change that cost-benefit calculus. And I have seen in the former Yugoslavia how the intervention of international criminal justice dramatically changed that cost-benefit calculus. Now, what is the main issue that the international community speaks about in relation to Iran? It's the nuclear issue. What we hear time and again is the nuclear issue is the central focus. Now, I don't intend to speak about the nuclear issue. That's not my subject of expertise. But what I do want to say is that the root of all problems in Iran, both for the people of Iran and for the international community, is the lack of accountability for human rights violations. It's the lack of a democratic culture. We do not worry about regimes that have nuclear capability when they are democratic in nature, when they're responsive to their people's real needs. And we have seen throughout history that a regime that uses mass violence as an instrument against its own people is more likely to project its violence abroad, also through violence. So in that sense, the international community, beyond the General Assembly resolutions and condemnations, has to begin to make human rights the central parameter of its dealings with the regime in Iran. One of the questions we have to ask ourselves, for example, is why does the UN Security Council adopt targeted sanctions, which imposes travel bans and asset freezes against individuals and companies involved in the nuclear program, but makes no such gesture with respect to those leaders that are responsible for widespread systematic human rights abuses? Why are those individuals not similarly subject to asset freezes and travel bans, even as a purely symbolic gesture to the democratic movement and human rights movement within Iran, that the international community stands with them and that they're willing to take seriously the question of impunity for human rights abuses? One of the questions we have to ask ourselves, further to what Shadi Sadr has told us, is how can we begin to move towards a new paradigm in which accountability becomes an essential ingredient of the transformation of Iran, not simply a transformation which is a factional power struggle where one political elite with tyrannical attitudes is replaced by another political faction with similarly tyrannical attitudes. One of the lessons of 1979, which of course was the 31st anniversary of the revolution, was yesterday. It's an interesting coincidence that Iran's human rights record is being considered at the UN at this time. But one of the lessons is that genuine change is not simply about replacing one set of political elites with another set of political elites. It's about a grassroots transformation. It's about political maturation. It's about changing people's expectations and political consciousness. The great promise that the future of Iran has is because of those millions of people marching in the streets, demanding human rights, demanding justice, a sort of post-ideological, broad-based movement that has great power in the simplicity of its demands that human rights be respected and that those responsible for abuses be brought to justice. It's in that context that we have to understand the importance of making accountability a central ingredient of the transformation of Iran and of building a truly democratic culture. In that respect, there are many lessons to be learned from the experience of countries as diverse as South Africa and how it dealt with apartheid-era crimes, Argentina's attempts to deal with the crimes of the military junta during the Dirty War, the model of international criminal justice, which we saw in relation to the former Yugoslavia. Each of those has a lesson for the Iranian experience as civil society and the international community, in partnership with the Iranian people, begin to forge a different path for the future of that country. Shadi Sadr explained correctly that Iran is not a signatory to the statute of the International Criminal Court. And it's very obvious why Iran would not want to be signatory to that statute, because many of its leaders could end up with arrest warrants against them for conduct, which by many definitions could realistically amount to crimes against humanity, crimes within the subject matter jurisdiction of that court. But there's nothing to stop a future democratic Iranian government from signing the statute of the International Criminal Court. And if we had this discussion a year ago, when most people assumed that there is really no civil society movement capable of challenging the hardliners, it may have seemed unrealistic. But today we can realistically speak about a new Iran within the foreseeable future. None of us can give an exact date, but what we see in Iran is a seismic shift which inevitably will bring about change. The question is when and at what cost. The point is from now to begin to document those crimes, to make them a central ingredient of the discourse of the international community in order to deter leaders who may be tempted now to escalate violence to the point of mass executions, which is a real possibility if the regime feels that its power is being subject to serious challenge. And we have seen from the experience of 1988, in which we witnessed what I consider in a parallel to Yugoslavia, Iran's Srebrenica. As you know, Srebrenica in the Yugoslav war symbolized in one single mass execution of some 7,000 Bosnian Muslims the excesses of the war. Although there were many executions in Iran, in 1988, when about 4,000 leftist prisoners were systematically executed, that became really a symbol of the excesses. And we have, among the reports of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center, one of the most comprehensive accounts of those events. And we see that all of the individuals that were involved in that mass execution, this so-called death commission, went on to be promoted, went on to become ministers and senior advisors, and many of them are still part of the Iranian regime. The point that I'm trying to address here is that at some point, consideration has to be given to how one can come to terms with such widespread and systematic criminality, because it is simply not possible to prosecute each and every person that has been involved in 30-year-long campaign of massive atrocities. And that is one of the challenges that Iranian society has to face, as on the one hand, it calls for accountability, but on the other hand, it has to facilitate a peaceful and non-violent transition by giving those involved in the existing state and security apparatus really an incentive to peacefully surrender power. One possible model is to create either an international criminal jurisdiction, perhaps by having a future government sign the statute of the International Criminal Court and retroactively refer crimes to that court, or possibly to have some sort of national trial within Iran, which is credible, which has perhaps the participation of the United Nations and other international elements, and to restrict prosecutions to those leaders that are most responsible for these atrocities. That has been the model that we've seen in the former Yugoslavia, in Rwanda, and in many other cases, where it's simply not possible to prosecute tens of thousands of people. And perhaps it's not even desirable in the name of healing and national reconciliation to do that. And at the end of the day, a criminal trial is not about the victims. It is about the accused. It is about the defendant. And one cannot, in a criminal trial, have tens of thousands of victims come and tell their stories. And that was the power, perhaps, of the African Truth and Reconciliation Commission model, which allowed a genuine process of national healing where tens of thousands of people who had lost their loved ones, who themselves had been tortured and abused, could come and have a vindication of their suffering, to be given some sort of public recognition to what had happened, and to allow that whole truth-telling process to counter the years of misinformation and propaganda and hate-mongering, which had twisted and distorted the culture to one which was not compatible with human rights. So we have to begin this discussion, which Shadi Sadr referred to, the future of Iran. We have to begin that discussion now. We have to start thinking about the different modalities and the complexities of holding individuals accountable, perhaps in some cases through prosecutions, perhaps in other cases through amnesties in exchange for confessions where there have been abuses. And the message is a very complex one, because on the one hand, the message must be to the leaders that if they resort to mass executions and violence, that they will be held responsible, while perhaps the wider message to those that find themselves enlisted in this massive repression apparatus should be that it is also possible to have a country in which there will be forgiveness, in which there will be reconciliation, and hopefully that possibility will create a further incentive for people to lay down their arms and allow for a peaceful transformation. So I want to once again thank you, all of you, for your support and to thank the great staff of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center. 5 years ago, when the organization was established, this discussion that we're having today was seen as something totally remote, unrealistic, and irrelevant. And it's particularly heartwarming for me to see today how far we have come and how much further we have to go, but still how close we are now to perhaps realizing a vision of a different Iran in which human rights are respected and in which the rule of law prevails. Thank you very much.